Well, because you all are simultaneous individuals or have very little dust in your eyes, you are of the type of people that as soon as you hear the instructions, you realize them. And so because of that, we are ready to move on and put shamatha to practice now. Or I mean, really use it in the way that it's intended to be used. And so as Lama Alan Wallace terms it, shamatha is the technology. And so technology is neutral, could be used for blowing up world systems or, you know, growing good food or whatever. But so we have the technology of shamatha now. And so it's time to really put it to work. And so the way that we do this is by moving on to vipassana practice. So the classic progression is that you achieve shamatha first, and then you do vipassana practice. And this is, of course, recognized in all Buddhist traditions, really. But it's very few Buddhist traditions that actually follow that progression. And so because people are very impatient and want to move on to vipassana, or vajrayana, very few people actually put in the time to achieve shamatha. So the classic progression is it's essential to develop shamatha first. And the reason, you know, so you find hundreds of citations why, you know, about the importance of developing shamatha first. And so here is just one from Kamala Shila, who was one of the great shamatha masters of Tibet, of India, actually, who went to Tibet for a brief time anyway. So Kamala Shila, in his second stages of meditation, says, with bare insight that lacks serenity or shamatha, the yogi's mind is distracted by objects. Like an oil lamp in the wind, it will not be stable. For this reason, what sublime wisdom sees will not be very clear. And what that means also is that it won't be very stable. And I think that this is a very, very common experience of Dharma practitioners and has been for millennia, that you have insights, real insights into, I would just guess that a large number of people in this room have had authentic experiences of non-duality, you know, real serious experiences of emptiness. And, you know, here we are still, you know, that we have these experiences, but they don't last. They're not stable. So in terms of developmental psychology, etc., these would be called peak experiences. And so we have these peak experiences, which are states of consciousness. So because they're states, they come and they go. And so what we need to do is turn the states into traits or stage development. And so when you when you attain a stage development in developmental psychology, then it's irreversible, right? Like Piaget's conservation of volume or something, or the acquisition of language. When you get that, you don't have to reboot every time. It's just there until you die, basically, and or get really old. And so what we would like is for these insights, actually, that we have to be so stable that they become stage developments or traits. So states versus traits. And so shamatha is the thing that is necessary to do that, to turn wisdom into a trait, something that is, what when we get it, we've got it. And we don't go back to being, to forgetting it all and basically acting and perceiving as if nothing happened when we have these insights. So first of all, we achieve shamatha in order to make vipassana stable, but we don't really want to wait until we achieve shamatha before we practice vipassana, because it works the other way also. Vipassana makes shamatha stable also, because your shamatha, and Dujam Lingpa had this experience. This guy has a pedigree as good as it gets, and was sent to this world directly by Padmasambhava, basically, to straighten out the misconceptions about Dzogchen in Tibet. So, he came directly, at the behest of Padmasambhava, and he didn't want to come, but Padmasambhava said, go. And so even Dujam Lingpa, basically, would, because he was a prodigy, would have these experiences of pristine awareness where he said he would be able to rest for long periods of time. But when he had mental affliction, but he was still susceptible to mental afflictions. And that was because he hadn't really completed Vipassana practice. And then a Dakini came to him and gave him some practices, basically. Or it was Dorje Drolo, actually, that appeared to him and gave him Vipassana practices to work on to make his experiences of pristine awareness stable. So the reason that if we don't do Vipassana practice as well, we can, as we're practicing shamatha, as long as we are resting in shamatha, and we're resting in non-conceptuality, everything is groovy. But as soon as a mental affliction arises, if we don't have the wisdom to see through it and see that it is only an appearance of mind and has the nature of mind, we could still very easily reify it and see that it's something much more concrete than it is. So the two of these work together really, really powerfully. And so that's why we're going to move on to Vipassana, even if you do still have some dust in your eyes, because it will help to remove the dust. So it's very important to not be satisfied with shamatha. And there's a real danger in it, because it is so seductive, right? You achieve luminosity, non-conceptuality, and bliss. What could be better than that, right? And you're just resting in luminosity, non-conceptuality, and bliss. Isn't that the end of the path? Isn't that the goal that you have been striving for ever since you thought about becoming a Buddhist, or since your first drug experience, or whatever? So you've got the luminosity, non-conceptuality, and bliss, and it's stable because you've achieved shamatha. So that has become a trait. So what could be better than that? Well, here's what Dujam Lingpa has to say about that. He says, in short, these practices from shamatha to luminous cognizant consciousness and the substrate consciousness, as taught previously, constitute the phase of taking the aspects of the mind as the path. But as long as it is divorced from the vipassana of knowing the nature of existence, this does not bring you even a hair's breadth closer to the path of liberation from the suffering of mundane existence and the path of omniscience that liberates from the two extremes. Thus, even if you strive diligently in these practices for a long time, this does nothing more than perpetuate samsara. So understand how your life will certainly have been spent in vain. So, and it's said more specifically that if you really crave the peace of shamatha, and remember there's a bodhisattva vow about that, that you don't crave this peace of quiescence. If you do, what you're doing is just planting karmic seeds to be born in the form or formless realms. So, still samsaric being. So you haven't advanced one hair's breadth yet. And to take that giant step, not just a hair's breadth, but a giant step towards liberation, towards genuine freedom, we need to deploy vipassana practice. The Buddha taught vipassana in different stages. And the first stage that the Buddha taught vipassana in was his very first teachings, the Four Noble Truths. You know, so what is the truth of suffering and what is the cause of suffering? And then vipassana really being the path that is going to lead us. So there is a path and vipassana, shamatha vipassana, but real realization into the nature of self and absence of self is what is going to lead to freedom from suffering. So this is the first turning of the wheel, first vipassana practices. And the point of these teachings is that when you investigate closely, can you find a self within the aggregates of the body and mind? So is there a self there? And what you conclude when you do that investigation is that this self that seems so real and that we have an innate propensity to view ourselves this way, we can't find a self, and we recognize that it is only a construct that is pasted onto this composite of the body and mind. And so the just want to take this in order here. Yeah, so that's the essence of the first turning of the wheel, is the illusory nature of this I. And then because we have this designation of I, then there must be other. So it gets worse. Not only is there I, but there is other. And now that there is I and other, then this becomes the basis for craving, hostility, wars, everything. Because we are seeing a false dichotomy, basically, of self and other. And we can't get rid of this innate sense of I simply by vowing, I will not believe in this illusory self. We can't raise our right hand and repeat a creed. There is no such self. And then presto, liberation. You know, it is not that. We don't just, your membership in the club isn't sufficient. And so how is it that we then can be free from this illusion that is at the root of all of our suffering? So what is the cause of suffering? It is seeing an I and mine in that which is not I and mine. So that is the classic formulation. So how do we get rid of that? Well, it is not by mere study. It is not by proclamations, but it is by proving to yourself, by investigation and proving to yourself that this I is illusory, that it can't, by looking for this I that seems so real, that seems so immediate, the one that I protect and cherish, the I that I am willing to hurt others for in order to promote and to protect, that I. So if that I doesn't exist, when you look for it, if you prove to yourself that it doesn't exist, that it is nothing other than just another one of those concepts that disappears in a non-conceptual state, everything changes then once that happens. So this is the big difference between direct experience and conceptualizing an answer. And the approach in the sutras and in most Vipassana practice that I have, that I encountered in the first 20 or so years that I was studying and practicing Buddhism, the approach of Vipassana practice in other traditions other than Dzogchen and Mahamudra is that you, first of all, study. So it's hearing, then reflection, meditation, then hopefully realization, and then confidence in the realization. But it basically, a lot of traditions really emphasize and maybe get stuck in the study, the hearing, and maybe a little reflection. So this makes it, here is another insight from Ian McGilchrist and the master and his emissary. The value of the conceptual mind. So he was saying, you know, that there's, he points out a large part of his book is why our present dilemma in a contemporary society is based in this usurpation, basically, of the emissary becoming the master, the conceptual mind taking charge, basically. And so let's see, where was I going with that? The concepts. Oh, the value of the conceptual experience is that it, so awareness is implicit, meaning that it is global, can see relationships between a large number of disparate things, and it is implicit, meaning that basically it's hard to nail down. So when you were talking about your, or how do you communicate your experience of the sunset or of natural beauty to someone else if it in a non-conceptual way? You know, you might be able to do it through emotion and body language and something like that, but that's still implicit. It's kind of fuzzy. So the value of concepts is that they are by nature very precise. They are dictionary definitions, encyclopedia entries. This is the basis, you know, conceptions, and the conceptual mind is the basis of all art, science, religion. We wouldn't have the words of the Buddha and the teachings of the Buddha around for us to compare our own experience with and to learn from without the conceptual mind. So the value of this conceptual approach to understanding the nature of the I, the illusory nature of the I, of the sutras, is that it is very precise. 1,000 different arguments. One of my teachers used to say, who was a Geshe, we delight in 1,000 different arguments about emptiness, 1,000 different views. You know, it just jazzes them. These Geshes, there's nothing, you know, that gets a Geshe off more than the 1,000th and 10th argument. 10 new arguments for emptiness. You know, wow, what a day. And of course, that's extraordinary. But there's a big difference between conceptualizing an answer and experiencing it. And so even with the precision of the conceptual approach, we're still stuck with what Padmasambhava had to tell us. According to the custom of some teaching traditions, you are first introduced to the view, meaning conceptually, and upon that basis, you seek the meditative state or experience. This makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness. Your conceptualization of the view actually gets in the way, obstructs your experience of the view. So analysis is not really meditation. And analytical meditation, I'm not going to say that's not really meditation, because who knows what these lights might do. But there's great value in it. But it's based on inferential reasoning, and it's not experience. And so it's for this reason, then, that the sutric approach to understanding, to emptiness, the sutric approach to emptiness that depends on inferential reasoning is said to take 3 periods of countless eons. So a countless, you know, countless eons. And I think an eon is at least 1 expansion and contraction of the universe. So countless of those, and 3 of those, you know, you had better have a long working memory. So it's difficult. Well, it takes a long time, because what you're doing in that approach is you're actually accruing merit in order to transform the conceptual knowledge into an experiential realization. So it is so incremental and takes so long because you're using, basically, as Lama Tsongkhapa pointed out when he was debating an opponent, that, you know, what he was doing was addressing everybody agrees that our ultimate goal is non-conceptuality, you know, that when liberation is a non-conceptual state, so does using conceptual inference to try to move towards that, to actually develop that state, does that violate the law that cause and effect must be of the same nature? So it's interesting. Lama Tsongkhapa has a way of kind of finessing that, but the objection was really interesting and very compelling. And I think that's basically what Padmasambhava is saying here, is that actually does hold, or it's very difficult to, and that explains why it takes so long, basically, to get from here to there, if we are just continually enhancing and elaborating the conceptual mind to do it. And then the primary difference between that approach of conceptually elaborating emptiness and what we're doing in Mahamudra and Dzogchen and Vajrayana in general is that we rely, these traditions rely on direct experience. So your direct experience then is going to, could be instantaneous, you know, because it's going to be a moment-to-moment experience. And so this is why then Padmasambhava continued that citation, or in that citation, in this tradition, meaning his own, you first establish the meditative state, then on that basis you are introduced to the view. So you first develop shamatha, etc. So this profound point makes it impossible for you not to identify pristine awareness. So there you have it, your choice. Therefore, first settle in your mind, settle your mind in its natural state, and bring forth genuine shamatha in your mind stream, and reveal the nature of pristine awareness. So we are basically in Dzogchen and Mahamudra, Vipassana practice means looking at the mind directly, not thinking about it, not analyzing it, not conceptualizing it, but just observing it. And you can have a question in mind while you're observing it, but basically the point of it is that you, first of all, have to train your powers of observation to look at it directly. So that is powerful reasoning for why it's so much faster to use this direct approach of observation. And then Trungpa Rinpoche points out another reason why in something also very compelling, why in Mahamudra and Dzogchen, the approach is that we work directly with the nature of the mind rather than the nature of phenomena. And what he points out is that if you are going to try to fathom the nature of phenomena, all these external appearances, they are, the illusion is so powerful. They look like they're solid, concrete, independent of me. And that the only way to cut through that is with inferential logic. Because our senses are lying to us about that. And so we can't rely on direct observation of phenomena in order to give us the truth about the emptiness of phenomena, because they seem to be inherently real external objects independent of my mind. So that creates a problem. On the other hand, what the Mahasiddhas realized was that the mind is very manifestly empty, meaning that it is insubstantial. You know, we can observe the insubstantiality of the mind directly. So it's a much easier route to understanding and fathoming directly with experience emptiness, because we are working with something that isn't so powerfully illusory. Our minds seem to, because they're not concrete. It's like the opposite. You know, we set up this dichotomy of that's concrete, real existence out there, and this is all dreamscape in here. You know, so the dreamscape appears to us as a dreamscape, really. It's easy to observe. So that is the approach of the Mahasiddhas, and explains why it is so fast and so efficient. And here in this text, and pointing out the Dharmakaya and Ocean of Definitive Meaning, in Ocean of Definitive Meaning, there are three main categories of Vipassana. Pointing out the Dharmakaya actually has five, but Ocean of Definitive Meaning lumps a couple together. So we have basically looking at the mind within stillness, looking at the mind within movement, and then looking at the mind within appearances. So that is all basically how Vipassana practice is organized, but you are looking at the nature of mind, all three of these, and you're using different questions, basically. You're looking at the mind in stillness, the mind in movement, which means thought, and then appearances, to all, and how all of these, through your direct observation, can prove to you, beyond the shadow of a doubt, the nature of your mind. And so looking at, we're going to begin, and the Vipassana progression begins with looking at the mind within stillness. And so when we are doing that, the practice, this Vipassana practice, begins with shamatha, meaning that you first of all have to get your mind into this state of stillness of shamatha, or your best facsimile of it, and then you look at the nature of the mind that is still. That's it. And so in the Sutrayana approach, in the Theravadin approach, we are looking for the I, and we realize that it is just a construct that has been projected onto the body and the mind. But the mind, that's there. That's real, right? The mind must be there. Dujam Lingpa, in the very beginning of Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, says, the mind is primary. The mind is the all-creating sovereign. So does that mean that the mind is inherently real and everything else is a creation of this one inherently real phenomena? You know, are we Chittamatrans? Are we mind-only school? Meaning that mind exists truly, inherently, and everything else is just a dream, basically, of this mind. So that's what we are going to examine, is the self-existence of the mind. And then the power of that in Dzogchen and Mahamudra is that if we can fathom the empty nature of the mind, then everything that is produced by the mind just falls into place as an empty phenomenon. So if the mind that produces all these phenomena is empty, everything obviously produced by the mind is nothing other than the mind that produced it, and is just as empty. So you don't have to sort through all the categories of phenomena and say, is this one empty? Is this one empty? Is this one empty? If the mind produces all phenomena, then, and if you can determine the empty nature of the mind, then you've done it. You know, what else is there? So to guide our investigation and our observations while we are looking at this mind that is resting in stillness, we have a series of questions to guide our investigation. And the one that we begin with is that when you are looking at the mind that is still, will you actually find a thing? When you're looking for the mind that is still, will you find a thing that is still? Will you find something with substantial characteristics? And is there something that you can actually point to and say, this is the mind that is still? That's what we're going to be looking for. So if there is a mind, we talk about the mind in stillness. So if there is a mind that is still, we should be able to find it, right? So that's what we're going to be looking for. But this is how Nagarjuna basically put it when he said, when he was telling us what, you know, don't really expect to find what you're looking for. He said, the mind is a mere label, and it is nothing other than a label. recognize awareness as a mere label. Moreover, a label has no intrinsic nature. Thus, the mind is of the nature of an apparition, and the nature of the mind does not exist as any type of color or shape, as something apprehended, or as an apprehender, as a man, a woman, or a neuter, and so forth. Not only as an apprehended, but as an apprehender. In short, the Buddhas have not seen it, and they will not see it. They accurately see it as having the nature of being without an intrinsic nature. So this is very helpful to have this authoritative statement that the Buddhas haven't seen it when looking for the nature of a substantial mind, because that can give us confidence that when I really go looking for it, and I really do my best, and I'm very diligent in my searching, and it's like looking for buried treasure on a beach, and you know, you don't just dig one hole and say, I heard there was buried treasure on here, but I dug a hole and it's not there. You basically just think that, well, I didn't dig in the right spot. So you have to keep digging. And then finally, at some point, you just say, well, not only have I not found it, but it is not to be found. So that's exactly what the Buddhists discovered. Not only had they not found it, but it was not to be found. And so when we get to that point then the search is over. We realize that, and we can conclude that with confidence that what I believed to exist so concretely, so substantially, simply does not exist in the way that I thought it did. So if you look for these substantial characteristics, and everything that exists exists by way of its characteristics or has characteristics that can be known, otherwise it makes no sense to say that something exists if it has no characteristics. So if we can't find any substantial characteristics to what we are looking for, must we then conclude that the mind doesn't exist at all? Well, that would be a problem. Yeah, what is it that came to that conclusion? So to avoid this becoming, again, just another conceptual exercise and just conceptualizing an answer, which is going to be of some value, but of limited value, we have to keep our observations in the present moment. So it's all of the skills and techniques that you learned with your shamatha practice that you are going to be able to apply in your vipassana investigation, because you are directly observing this mind in stillness moment to moment to moment in the only way that awareness exists. And what we want to avoid is what is called the patch of concepts, which means that we confuse our conceptual experience and our knowing with actual experience. And this is very, very easy to do because of self-fulfilling prophecies and the confirmation bias and all of that. Things that, and this is, you know, exactly what contributes to polarization in politics in the age of the internet, right? Because it's so easy to get only the information that confirms what you already believe. So is that what we're doing? Is, do we basically, are we bringing our belief about the nature of the mind to our observation, and then letting that belief become the observation, basically. Or just because we are so unfamiliar with what direct observation really is, and our minds are so imbued with conceptuality that we don't even recognize, because remember, the conceptual mind believes that it's the only thing that exists. So is that all we're doing, is basically just thinking the right answer again? And that, again, is part of the power of shamatha, in that we have, first of all, learned how to become comfortable in a state of non-conceptuality. And then we're simply looking at that state again with a non-conceptual mind. We might have a question in the background, but our observation is just direct and non-conceptual. And so, as Trungpa Rinpoche pointed out again here at this point, in order for this to be effective, you have to be looking at the mind that you are looking at, the stillness of the mind that you are looking at. Let's call it the mind of the first moment. You have to be looking at the mind of stillness of the first moment with the mind of the first moment. You can't be looking at the mind of the first moment stillness with the mind of the second moment vipassana, and observing it with the mind of the second moment, because the mind of the first moment no longer exists at that point, and the only way that you can get it from the first moment to the second moment is to conceptualize it. And then what you're dealing with is, you know, back to indirect observation of just trying to understand a concept. So because of that, our observations have to be grounded again in the present moment. And our observations in Vipassana practice are also going to be now, fresh, now, fresh. And if we are able to do that, then the mind that is observing and the mind that is observed will be simultaneous. And because they are simultaneous, there will no longer be the bifurcation of duality into subject and object. And then lastly, the state of stillness that we're going to be looking at, the mind that is resting in the state of stillness. The stillness could be of two different types, Trungpa Rinpoche points out. Ninth Karmapa actually pointed this out. So the stillness that we're looking at could be of either two types. And I mentioned this yesterday, when you get to the ocean, the third type of resting, it could be either the glassy smooth ocean at night or the glassy smooth ocean during the day. So we, in order for this, our Vipassana practice to be effective, the stillness that we're looking at has to be not only still, but it has to be brilliantly clear, luminous as well. So it's not just the spaced out stillness, because that is not going to give us the information that we need. We're not going to be, it's not the object that we need to observe. So what we are first going to do then, when we come back for our meditation, is to generate that mind of stable stillness, luminous cognizance. And then we're going to look at the nature of the mind that is still, the nature of luminous cognizance itself, and see what we observe. But before we do that, let's take a break, and we'll come back at 2:30 and do a meditation.